Welcome to a special two-part episode of The Three Horsemen. We're very lucky tonight to have two guests and promise an interesting and long episode. Fair warning, if you listen carefully enough, you may learn some interesting news.
Fred and Jeff and John are the Three Horsemen. They never get along, they're the Three Horsemen. They argue about science fiction and fantasy. Fred and Jeff and John are the Three Horsemen. Ride, horsemen, ride!
Good evening and welcome to the February 2016 episode of The Three Horsemen. Except tonight we have the honor of being the Five Horsemen, as we have roped in two guests, and we're going to determine tonight exactly how far a .45 caliber bullet fired from a Mark 1911 semi-automatic handgun can penetrate a David Weber novel. So having said that, let me introduce first the junior and newer end of a new partnership, Joel Presby. Good evening, Joel.
Hi, thanks for having us.
And if anybody hasn't guessed it by now, the senior of member of the new writing partnership, David Weber.
Hi.
And, of course, my two regular co-hosts, Mr. Jeff Patterson.
How you doing? Jeff Patterson. Jeff Patterson 11 on Twitter.
And Mr. John Stevens.
Yep, and I am Erudite Ogre on Twitter.
And I am Fred Kish on Twitter, as well as blogging at Bernal Alpha and generally losing my sanity point by point, thanks to work. So, we wanted, as regular listeners know, we've been kind of meandering around the publishing world over the past year. We've had a editor on, publisher, we've had an art director, we've had authors, we've had new authors, we've had veteran authors. So tonight it's time to talk about something that I really don't encounter outside of science fiction. That's the collaboration. During the Golden Age, we had a couple of famous husband-wife teams. Edmund Hamilton and Lee Brackett wrote a couple of stories together, but more famously there was C.L. Moore and Henry Kuttner. Wrote a lot of stories together to the point where it is rumored that when one got up from a typewriter, the other would sit down and even complete sentences. So in the late 1950s, Fred Pohl collaborated with the late Cyril Kornbluth, most famously on The Space Merchants. Later, Pohl started the work with Jack Williamson. And in the 70s, one of my favorite books was written between Larry Niven and Jerry Pournelle with The Moat in God's Eye. Mm-hmm. And then there was an explosion in the 80s and the 90s with lots and lots of people collaborating. And in fact, Bain Books, where the home of our two authors tonight, is almost like a farm or a factory full of collaborations where people come in, they hook up with a senior author, and they eventually spin off on their own or join an ongoing series, as we're going to talk about tonight, or add to a series, or collaborate on an anthology. I mean, it's just amazing the number of authors that people like David Weber and Eric Flint have brought into existence. Mm-hmm. So, Joelle.
Yes.
Tell us about, how did you get here?
Well, it's all my husband's fault.
Okay. Always a good place
to start. Yes. It's all Andy Presby's fault. David, you might have heard, writes a lot of stories. And once upon a time, there was this Honor Harrington series. And David and Tony Weiss... Yes, there still is. And David and Tony Weisskopf at Bain were talking about doing something special for the 20th anniversary of the first book on Vasilik Station being published. And David's got this incredible amount of history and background and technical detail for all of his series, and especially for that very well-selling one. Bain thought maybe there'd be interest in some kind of tech Bible compendium thing. And David, feel free to chime in here also.
I just like the compendium
Fictional nonfiction encyclopedia, I think, was what the final contract was.
Well, it started out, we were almost thinking of doing like a concordiat to the Honorverse, and then we realized that we would all die.
It's just too much.
So we fell back to the next fallback position, which was to do the Honorverse Companion. Go ahead, Joelle, go ahead.
For those readers out there, I'm sure everyone is very grateful that David didn't do it all himself. And so is not years behind in his writing. And so he went and grabbed a bunch of people who provided tech help. And Bane didn't want to write a contract to a dozen people. And so that group incorporated as BU9. And I've been in the background going along and enjoying being around BU9, but always refusing to join because I like writing my own stuff.
Yeah, let me throw this in for a minute.
Yes.
BU9 existed as an entity well before we started doing Companion Guys.
But it hadn't incorporated.
It hadn't incorporated. And I told them that that's what they ought to do so that we could, number one, approach Bane with them as a single entity. And number two, God forbid, they might actually get paid a little bit for all of the hours and hours of volunteer labor of love work they had already done on the Honorverse. As Andy says, I can retcon that, which takes care of a lot of continuity errors that are, oh, no continuity errors here, kind of thing. So when the Companion came along, the notion of the Companion first came along really a couple of years before where Joelle's picked up on the story. And there was just like, I'd really love to do that, but there's no way in the world I can do it. I'd really love. And then I said, oh, wait. I know somebody who could. And like
Tom
Sawyer
got a lot of.
Here's my fence.
Tom Sawyer to a lot of people.
Here's my fence. You know, get your brush.
Stop painting it. About nine people who were kind of the core who were going to make this happen. And Andy was one of them. And then promises had been made, but the Navy also thought that Andy worked for them still, and he still does. And Andy got a new job as an executive officer, and the time he thought he would have just went up in smoke. And so I was afraid that the project wasn't going to happen. So I stepped in and started doing some of the work, and one thing led to another. Because I was doing work for it, even though I was claiming to be not part of it, and eventually getting paid for it, Tony and David wanted a story or something related to Honorverse to put on Bane.com, free fiction. And so I wrote a Honorverse-related short story and was reluctant to show it to anybody, so I showed it to Tom Pope in BU9, and he gave it to Gina and to Sharon Rice-Weber, and those
Sharon Rice-Weber being David Weber's
wife. David without telling me. And so my reluctance was overcome by friends, and David gave me some advice for polishing it up and then sold it to Tony and then invited me to write in the Honorverse in an anthology and then invited me to help him with continuing the story of the multiverse.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's all Andy's fault.
Yeah. Like I say, always good to start with it's his fault.
Or blaming your spouse, yes.
Well, see, I think...
Well, this takes credit, but you know.
I think women have been doing that for the last 50,000 years to get even with Adam. That's all. Okay, just thought I'd throw that in. That's pretty much where it was, except that in some ways, Joelle is brushing over some of the reasons why I approached her about taking this up. And what I mean by brushing over is I didn't just invite her because I like her and the BU9 guys. I invited her because there was something about the short fiction she'd done that I really, really liked and that I thought showed that she had the storyteller's voice, whether she had a whole lot of experience yet or not. Okay? I think that a lot of people who would like to write but who don't think that they have the talent, the capability, whatever, I think they overlook the fact that writing is a skill like any other skill. Storytelling is the art. Storytelling is where the hard part is. Now, I could be, you know, writing comes easily to me after I started doing it in the fifth grade, which are years ago. But I honestly believe that the thing that makes a successful writer is that writer's voice. And that has less to do with writing skill than it does with the way that you think and the way you put a story together. Okay? And learning to write, you can do just like you learn to walk. If you do enough of it, fall down often enough, you'll get the hang of it. Okay? And I think more people could do it than believe they could do it. And so when I saw these stories of Joelle's, I wanted to encourage her to get out there and actually do it. And I think that The Road to Hell, which is our first project together, amply justifies my faith in that regard. Joelle, I haven't had a chance to tell you.
Mm-hmm.
I got an email from somebody who had been waiting, like, 7 years for the next one in this area. And he said that he was delighted with the way that it picked up right where the last one stopped, that he really liked the flow, the fact that we had the same characters and they were still the same people for the established characters. And he especially liked the citations.
Oh, good.
So I thought I would tell you that because the citations are Joelle's baby in this book. And that's the kind of positive feedback that I think it's important when somebody gives it to you that you pass it on to your collaborator. And I just haven't had a chance to talk to Joelle since I got the email. I got it this morning. But Joelle actually in The Road to Hell had a tougher row to hoe than you do in a lot of collaborations because it was not simply a collaboration with me. We were also fusing in material that had spun off and in many cases was left from the collaboration that I had done with Linda Evans on the first two books. And the second of the multiverse books went in a totally different place from where Linda and I had originally assumed it was going to go. So when Joelle and I started on this, we had a bunch of material that didn't really fit with where the storyline had gone. And we had to determine what of it we were going to keep, what of it we were going to lose, and how we were going to modify to make it fit. And
My first task was to read through the two books, which I had read before. I read them both through twice. Making list of who was still alive and where they were and who was dead. Because
fortunately, there weren't too many of them left alive.
Yeah. One person who needed to be dead already.
Yes.
I no longer remember who that was, but there was a character like, no, I can't have that scene anymore.
Well, you know, it's kind of like the Night of the Living Dead, you know, it's like...
But we don't have zombies in this series.
Not yet.
True.
But it was, like I say, it was a little bit more of a challenge. And in some ways... It was a really hard book for me to get back into, too, because if you think about it, there's a lot more world building in this one than there are in a lot of others. You have two unique civilizations living on two different planets that are identical to our own. They have their own societies. They have their own place names for everything on the face of the planet.
Well, before we get any further, maybe I should... fill this in for those who haven't read the series. I mean, it's the multiverse series. You've got a seemingly infinite number of Earths that are connected by portals. But the problem is that not all the Earths, as far as I can tell, look the same as far as
They all look pretty much the same.
Sure, U.S., you know, North America, South America, but the U.S. might be covered with jungle in one universe.
No. Okay. Physically, they're pretty much the same.
Okay.
There's some differences because you got different patterns of erosion and so forth. And the portals themselves, because they tend to be at different altitudes, you have something they call the portal wind that blows through it when they're trying to equalize temperatures. And that can cause all sorts of interesting things. We've got one place where I think it's the Colorado River flows into a portal and makes a new river on the other side, and the old riverbed is dry, that kind of thing.
And the big problem is that one portal might, your exit portal might be open in New Jersey, but the next entrance portal is in California. You have to get from New Jersey to California.
Or in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. That's fun, too.
Yeah. Yes.
But the real killer is that there are these two civilizations, both humans, that are expanding. And they've expanded through quite a few universes. I mean, the Arcanans have been doing it for like 200 years. The Charonians only started like about 80 years before the book. And they have never encountered another human civilization anywhere. And so when they do encounter one another, one of them uses magic, and it works. And the other one uses essentially Newtonian physics, and they work. And I use the term Newtonian physics deliberately because in the books, this hasn't really been indicated yet, but in the books, light speed really is instantaneous for the Charonians. Okay? So this would be like for laser rangefinders. This would constitute a small problem. It's not just that there's a different mindset. There are actually different laws of physics in the universes. And neither of them has realized it during their exploration because their technology has always worked fine in the new virgin universes. And that's the suspension of disbelief section in this book. And of course it was a David Weber novel, so there had to be a war. And there is. But when you get into building two societies, two universes that are both that divergent and convergent, and you haven't been there in 7 years, trying to remember where you are. The index finally published in the book is only about a third, maybe half, of the index that I actually, the index and the glossary that Joelle and I actually prepared for the book, because we have to have entries in it for terrain features, for example, in our universe, with the names for both of the other universes, so that we can find them.
Yes.
It's
Google Maps was very useful, actually. Google.
Yes,
Earth.
It is. I have an application that I use that is like Acme Mapper or something that is really, really cool. I actually like it better than Google Earth, but man, without modern mapping software available, this would be crazy. Mm-hmm. And actually, you were talking about how collaborations work and how technology impacts them. Joelle and I couldn't do this, certainly not the way that we've been doing it, without the Internet.
Yes.
We don't live nearby.
No.
It's interesting how many of the collaborations you mentioned earlier were husband-wife or we live right down the block. Because you could sit down around the same kitchen table to work. And believe it or not, Bunine has done that upon occasion, gathering in South Carolina and sitting around the Weber table while we kick stuff around. But that only happens maybe once, twice a year, if we're lucky. On the other hand, right this minute, all five of us are sitting around the kitchen table for all intents and purposes because of this conference connection. And that's made it, I try to imagine what it would be like to do a collaboration, say, the 60s or the 70s. And the mind boggles.
Yeah. postage costs would have been enormous.
Well, Steve White and I did our first collaboration by mail with him in Charlottesville, Virginia, and me in Greenville, South Carolina. And I'll tell you something we found that was very interesting. Mail took 4 days longer to get from Charlottesville to Greenville, which proved, as I had always thought, that Virginia sucks. Okay? Because it just went poof! It was like dropping it into a pneumatic tube to get it to him. And I'd get it in his postmark, like, you know, a week. And I'm like, is somebody at the post office, like, trying to read this while we're doing it?
Well, Hayford Pierce in the 70s wrote a series called Chap Fooey Rider, in which the guy realized that mail, the farther apart you were in mailing something, the faster the message would be received. So he actually discovered aliens by sending a mail as a joke to, like, Alpha Centauri. They're like, oh, we've been waiting for you to figure this out so we can contact you. By the way, we breathe pollution. Can we have all your pollution? So, I mean, in many ways, this is a three-way collaboration, though, because Linda was working on it with you, David.
Yeah.
Yes.
And now, I mean, you know, I've not gotten through the whole third book yet, but, you know, you've been able to keep, like, you know, as your email person said, you've been able to keep the substance and the voice and the flow and, you know, everything else going.
Well, what happens in most collaborations is, and I have to say, all the collaborations I've done, every single one has been different because the collaborator's been different. And there's I try and find the best way to work with whoever the collaborator is. Okay, and on some of them, like Steve and I did our books by dividing the characters, and each of us wrote the scenes that our characters were the point of view characters in, and if the other guy's characters were in the scene, he got veto right on what they did.
Mm-hmm.
And then I did the final edit and put it all together. And when Eric and I do collaborations, when I play in his universe, he's the scene editor, the senior partner. He plays in the Honorverse, I'm the senior partner. And that helps a lot. On the Prince Roger books, I guess I'm still technically the senior partner. But John, oh my God, did he have a steep learning curve after we got started on that. Fred, I know that you referred earlier to Bain as sort of a collaboration farm.
Mm-hmm.
And some people would consider that a derogatory.
No,
but I know you didn't mean it that way. The way that the Prince Roger books came into existence was that John really, really, really has that storyteller's voice that I was talking about. But he had, I believe, Him Before Battle was the first piece of fiction that he ever wrote, at least that he ever submitted anywhere.
Right.
And so his skill set wasn't up to his weight as a storyteller yet. And so Jim said, David, you know, would you do a couple of books with him and kind of, you know, mentor and whatnot? And I said, oh, sure. And so I did basically the tech Bible and the world building for the Prince Roger books, but I told John that I wanted him to build the flora and the fauna on Marduk. And God, if I'd known where that was going, I mean, 10 foot tall aliens, damn things, everything else in the world's great. But he's working away and I get this call from him, and we had a contract with Jim for like 3 books, I think. And, so John calls me and he says, I got almost 400,000 words. And I said, great. And he said, no, bad. And I said, why? And he said, because I'm halfway through the outline for the first book. And I said, oh, send it to me and I'll see what we can cut. And he sent it to me and I looked through and I could find a lot of stuff that I could tweak and could profit from it, but nothing in there that could be cut. So I called Jim and I said, Jim, I said, we got a problem. And he's like, what? And I said, well, how would you feel about a 4-book series instead of a 3-book series? And he said, well, let me think. Okay. You know, oh, hit me, beat me, make me write that check, sure. kind of thing. So that's how the Prince Roger novels grew. And I would like to go on record as pointing out that I was not the one who came up with all that extra word count. Okay. Sharon has informed me that I cannot write short fiction. And I simply say that the problem is how you define short. Okay. But I am not the one who put 400,000 words into the first half of the outline of the first book. Okay, Joelle?
Yes.
Okay.
You know, Marla told me that it was, Marla at Bain told me that it was the job of the collaborator working with David Weber to keep the page count down. and then later she told me I failed. So yeah. I just want to put that out there.
Well, okay, I will say this. I will say that the biggest weakness that you had, starting out, Joelle, was what I think is an oversensitivity to word count.
Yeah, I was trying to keep it down. It didn't work.
You were trying to keep it down. And the point is that what we need to do is we need to write it however long it needs to be written. And then if we have to, we can take out entire sections.
Yeah.
But the sections we keep can't afford to be starved for word count. And actually, the final word count on this book was not that bad, if not for the glossary. I mean, there's what, Joel? Do you remember how many pages of glossary there are in this, even with it cut down? There's a lot.
I want to say the arc that didn't have the glossary was 663, and the final hardcover with the glossary was 701. And so there's.
I seem to remember at one point that the glossary alone had like 75,000 words in it.
Yes, but they chopped our glossary pretty heavily.
Oh, yeah, they did. And I'm fine with what they did with it, I think. I haven't found anything essential that got left out. Anyway.
And we can always post the glossary on, like, davidweber.net or something.
Well, actually, Bain has it posted.
Oh, good. Okay.
That has nothing at all to do with our collaborations, though. Okay, Joelle?
Yes.
Okay, you need to now tell them the problems of working with me.
The problems of working with David Weber?
Yeah.
If I'm too detailed, what are my chances of continuing to work with David Weber? Because I...
Oh, better than average.
Well, have you already signed the contract for the next book? That's a good indicator.
I don't think we actually have signed a contract for the next book yet, but given the reception this one seems to be getting, I'm pretty sure that we will.
All right, then you're safe.
Yeah.
I'm pretty hopeful. Bain did offer me a contract for two solo novels, so I think they're not ready to, you know, throw me off the iceberg yet.
Yes.
You know, the sacrificial penguin to see if there's any killer whales out there.
Oh, the cetaceans wouldn't eat you. They like you.
One hopes.
Yes.
So
you wanted me to tell David Weber difficulty stories. Is that right?
Yeah. Obviously, you won't be able to think of one, but if you could, what?
You did say I'm a storyteller, so I can make things up, right?
That's true, yes.
All right, before I go on, I'm seeing in the chat an echo thing. Should I adjust something over here?
No, it's gone.
It's gone.
Oh, good. Okay.
We were getting an echo on David. I can try cleaning it up later. So.
Okay.
No.
Am I clear now?
Yes, you are. Thank you.
So, working with David Weber, I was a little concerned about it beforehand, so I went and researched David's collaborators. I don't know if I've told you this, David.
I know, you have.
I talked to Gina Robinson about people you'd worked with recently, and then I had coffee with Steve White and asked him to tell me everything that was difficult about working with David Weber to make sure I'd be ready for it.
Ooh.
Yes. And I gotta say, I was surprised about how easy it was. I was ready to have my little storytelling soul crushed.
Oh.
But that did not happen.
Well, first of all, your little storytelling soul is pretty good, pretty sturdy. And secondly, you know, it's, all right, here's the thing, and I've said this before, and, so, Joelle, you don't have to listen. I know you've heard it before.
Okay.
I won't do a collaboration just to increase output. Okay? I'll do a collaboration for sort of a cluster of reasons. Sometimes part of it is that there is a story that I need to tell that I don't have time to tell by myself, that I need to enlist someone else to help me get told, because, I don't know, I've got 7 or 8 series ongoing at the moment. So that can be a factor, but that's usually the smaller factor. What's more important to me is, number one, that I expect to enjoy working with the other writer. Number two, that I think I've got something to learn or something to teach. And no matter how new the other writer is, there's always something that you're going to learn working with them, and that you need to keep trying to learn whatever you're doing. And I want to be sure that the final product is going to be at least as good as either of the authors would have done on their own. And I operate on the theory that a collaboration is just that, and that the other writer is going to bring something to the table in the way they approach characterization, the way they describe action sequences, something that I didn't have on my own, and vice versa. So that I think the word is overused, but I'm talking about that synergistic effect of two people working together and bouncing ideas off each other. I mean, Joelle, do you have any idea how many comments we sent back and forth using the review function?
I don't know, but I do know that we reached the maximum that Microsoft Word could handle at one point.
I know that at one point I just hit accept all because I had like 88,000 that were literally like 88,000.
I didn't know that Microsoft had a maximum, but it does. It has a maximum both in the number of comments and the number of characters within a comment.
Mm-hmm.
And we hit them all.
We hit them all. Yeah. Well, okay, but that's part of what the internet makes possible, and it's also hugely, hugely beneficial when you are looking at that whole skill acquisition thing. Because I could say to Joelle, okay, I think we have a problem here because, and Joelle could say to me, yes, but if we change this here, then in chapter 13 we have that problem that you just really can't do in any kind of realistic time frame anyway but face to face or using the internet. I'm just, like I say, you know, to me, I started writing using a manual typewriter when I was in the fifth grade. And I am the world's last trained Linotype operators, which is one reason that I beat keyboards to death because of the keystroke on a Linotype machine.
Yep.
You know? And so I didn't quite start with a quill pen, but compared to where I was when I started writing, to where it is today when I use Dragon Naturally Speaking and voice recognition software, you know, everything else, the extent to which that allows you to increase your output without sacrificing quality is really remarkable. I still think sometimes that writers, and I've been guilty of this on occasion, have sacrificed a certain degree of quality because of schedule constraints. They're pushing so hard to get a book out or something, but that happened way before the internet ever came along. I'm pretty sure that Daniel Defoe had that problem. It's like John Milton invented voice recognition software, his daughters, okay, giving dictation to them. So, you know, it's just we're all inventing the wheel all over again. But it's really been remarkable. I know that I sold the first novel in 1989. That was Insurrection with Steve White. So that was 26 years ago.
Right.
Am I doing my math right? Okay. And I think that it may have been Honor Among Enemies, which was my first hardcover, That was also the first book that I was able to submit only in electronic format.
That was that. That wasn't with Dragon at that point, though.
No, it wasn't. I went with Dragon. Well, I don't know. What year was Honor Among Enemies? I got it on the shelf here. Wait, I'll look at the copyright date. Because I started using Dragon in 1999, due to the fact that that was when I shattered my wrist. And Honor Among Enemies is 1996. So, yes, it would have been before Dragon. I gotta say that I was really concerned about going with Dragon because it was, you know, gonna be so different from using a keyboard. And there are differences, but not anywhere near as many as I thought there would be.
But I know there's differences in commands and stuff, but did you have to train the way you work differently? Because by using a keyboard, you're kind of, you're throttling yourself back on purpose in one way, and that way you get kind of like a self-editing process going.
Well, to me, the self-editing process is not so much whether it's the keyboard or the voice. I did find that I had composed sentences at the speed that I typed.
Mm-hmm.
And with Dragon, obviously, you know, I can dictate like 250 words a minute. I don't know anybody in the entire universe who can write at that rate. But I think it definitely increased my output. Now, remember, though, that I started with, like, Dragon 2.1, I think. And nowadays, I think we're up to 13 or 14. So the difference in speech engines and capabilities is just absolutely enormous. And I've never tried any of the others because I have specialized vocabularies in Dragon for each of my series.
Right.
And trying to assemble those in a different program would be, that would be a pain. But, you know, okay, talking about collaboration, another collaboration that came out of BU9 is the series that Tim Zahn and Tom Pope and I are doing.
The
Travis series, that's right. And I look forward to at least, Joelle and I have at least one more multiverse book that needs to be written to wrap up this storyline.
Yes.
But we are hoping to leap forward to the point at which our universe becomes involved in all of this. And maybe finally unravel why there's a multiverse and why these portals exist. Because these portals are still coming into existence today. You'll discover a portal that's obviously brand new because of the strength of the portal wind blowing through it and that sort of thing. The first portal that they found, the portal that led them to the one that we call Hell's Gate, where Arcana and Sharona meet, was new enough that there were trees that had been cut in half when the portal formed that were still standing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So, you know, these portals, as far as they know, none of them have ever disappeared, but they're still coming into existence, and nobody knows why.
Yes. Neither side controls them, causes them to be moves where they are. They're just
now, there are two people in the entire multiverse who know. Actually, there are three, counting Linda. Okay? Who know what caused these portals to come into existence. And we would like to eventually reveal that to our wondering audience. And I don't think it's going to be what they think it is. But I have this scene, and it's really what started the entire multiverse, of this portal appearing in Georgia and eating the rear of Stonewall Jackson's horse on Stone Mountain. And a couple of dragons fly through it and get put down by Apache helicopters. Okay. See, that was the vision that started this entire series. Joelle will tell you, and so will Tom Pope, the most terrifying moments in working with David Weber are when he stops and says, "Ooh, shiny."
Yes, very much.
I've heard that story, yes.
I'm sorry. I can't help it.
Uh-huh. You're very well paid to not help it.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know,
people really wanted you to stop. They should have done things differently.
Oh, yes, yes, yes. They should never have encouraged me by actually paying me for it. I know that Isaac Asimov once said that his greatest fear was that one day the publishers would realize that he'd write whether they paid him or not. Mm. And I think that's probably true of most professional writers. Oh, and I wanted to say, you were talking about the fact that collaborations seem to be, if not unique to science fiction, at least more common in science mm-hmm. fiction. I think that's partly because sometimes collaborations aren't recognized as collaborations. For example, I really, really, really love Dean Koontz. But he has a group of writers and researchers who are participants in the books that he's writing. I'm not saying that they are not Koontz's vision at all. I'm not saying they're not his concepts, and I'm not saying that what you get at the end is Dean Koontz writing the novel. But I have a feeling that what you're looking at here is sort of Joel View 9, if you know what I'm saying.
Yes, makes sense.
Being very actively involved. And I consider that I've been collaborating with View 9 really for what, 6-7 years now, since Tom and I started corresponding regularly. Because
yeah, that seems about right.
Yeah, because you know, Tom especially has always been ever since he and I started corresponding, he's always been my sounding board for where I'm going with it. He and I just finished designing a new class of ships for the Honorverse earlier today. And, well, it's one that had been kind of floating around in the back of my brain. I knew it was out there, but I had never actually incorporated it into any of the novels. And so I've incorporated it into the one that I'm working on today. And Tom and I were talking earlier today on Skype. And I said, you know, yeah, I finally got around to doing the David Taylor class. And he says, the what? And I said, the David Taylor class. And Shirley, I mentioned that to you. And he said, David, you mentioned so many things to me. I didn't have my pad there to write it down, you know, more or less. And so I told him when it was. He was like, ooh, that could be interesting. So we talked about it back and forth, and boom, there it was. I love that kind of thing. And maybe that's one reason why I like collaborations as much as I do. It's funny because I am not, as a general rule, comfortable with sharing my work with the public in general until I'm satisfied that it's done. Okay? Some authors don't mind. They're comfortable doing it. Eric is much more comfortable with that than I am. Okay? But I love that spark-striking effect that you get when you're working with someone else. When there's someone who you trust enough that you'll take your concepts and you'll not just share them, which, trust me, takes a certain degree of courage and trust to do.
Mm-hmm.
But you'll not just share them, but you are actively inviting them to contribute to shaping and improving or expressing those concepts. And I think in some ways that writing, literature, is one of the disciplines that particularly lends itself to that. Okay, I think literature and music, and I would guess, okay, I would add to that today cinema, but to me cinema is an extension of literature and traditional storytelling, simply using a medium that Homer would have killed for. Does any of that make sense?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, every so often I start, you might not believe this, but every so often I just start off into my own little world.
Yeah, I really can't see a scenario where collaborating on a sculpture would not end in tears.
It would not end well for somebody.
Yeah, yeah.
And you know, painting, you know, if you're doing mosaics and, you know, Michelangelo, did he use any of his apprentices to do, like, the stuff that wasn't on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel?
Oh, he probably did.
Yeah. Well, I know that they just found, there's a museum, I think it's in the Midwest somewhere, that had this painting that had been done by one of the apprentices for a Renaissance painter. And there are only like maybe 15, 20 canvases known by him known to exist. And the organization in France that certifies his paintings just decided that this painting that they picked up somewhere as one of his apprentices' work that they've had in their museum for like 20, 30 years is a previously unknown work by him. Okay, and they're like, ooh, we need to increase security on this. You know, but yeah, I do what I do because I love telling stories. Okay, I mean, I really can't see myself not doing that. And when you find a collaborator you can work with, the storytelling only gets better. Okay? And that's the object in the end, I think. And I guess it's also important that you collaborate with somebody that you like.
Yeah, that helps.
Not all collaborators have liked each other, and not all collaborators have liked each other after they finish collaborating. You know, sometimes these things happen, you know. But I think that it helps that from my side, that I am, Joelle, check me on this if I'm wrong.
Actually, I hate you, David. I hate you.
Thank you. Oh, all right. I knew it was going to come out. Now that I am both, I'm both driven and easygoing.
You know, David, what was great about working with you is when you didn't like something that I'd written, you didn't just say, burn it all. You came back, this is why I don't think it works, and here's the way I'd fix it. But if I wanted to fix it another way and try another shot, you were also open to that, which is great.
Absolutely. Well, okay, I hadn't really thought about this for many, many years. But when you are the, quote, senior partner in a collaboration, what you're really doing in a lot of ways is editing when you're working on with the other side of the of the collaboration. And I had never thought of myself as an editor, but I had always said that a good editor was somebody who, if they had a problem, didn't tell you, fix it this way, but told you what the problem was and then let you fix it. Now that doesn't mean you can't say, and here's maybe how I'd fix it. Okay. Mm-hmm. But you have to let the other writer fix it. I can think of at least two or three occasions in The Road to Hell in which my saying to you, okay, we have a problem here, and you're saying, well, what if we fix it this way? Led to substantial improvement of other aspects of the book spinning off of the way that that particular problem had been dealt with.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another good thing that happens in collaborations. I think that happens in solo books too, but it's harder to do that in a solo book because the solo author isn't being pushed outside his own comfortable mode of creating and storytelling, unless he's pushing himself.
You're unlikely to get an editor reviewing it when it's half written.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say that one thing that happens to established authors, and in some ways it has happened to me, that is not necessarily good, is that they don't get edited as tightly as newer authors do, and in a collaboration, in a way, even if you're the senior partner, you have an editor involved in the process all the way along who can and will say to you, wait, I don't think that's working, and here's why. Okay?
Yeah.
And that's another good thing.
I'm kind of curious about that. So, in my mind, I'm thinking of somebody doing the outline of a scene or somebody going off an original outline and piecing together the way the scene is playing out, and then the other people kind of filling in the, kind of either fleshing it out or giving it a bit of texture or bringing another spin or angle of approach to a given scene.
Taking
the way you're saying it, I'm seeing it almost as the inverse, almost.
Well, not necessarily. Okay, it depends, because like I say, it's different with every collaborator. In this book, we had material that already existed. Joelle and I sat down, and we talked about where I had saw the original storyline going. I said, you know, I'd really like you.
And about the arc of the story as a whole.
The arc of the story as a whole. Not just this novel, but the entire, this is where we're going here. And then I sat down, and I'm not sure at what point exactly the process has happened, but I sat down and worked out, calendar dates for critical scenes that needed to be integrated. And I think I started, Joelle, check me on this because my mind is not totally clear on this. My mind is not totally clear on a lot of things, but, I think the way that it worked was I started by doing that for the scenes that I was writing because I had to nail down the movement of logistics and units and so forth and when who got where and whatnot. I think I did that, and then Joelle, we sat down and integrated the elements of the story that you were writing into it to make them fall in the right places, and that was a whole lot more interactive.
Yeah, at the second revision was when it became clear that, no, really, we need to know when the information reaches each side about certain key events based on the travel times of messaging systems.
Yes. And so you could say that I did a skeletal synopsis for the book. The problem is that if you say that, you're talking about the spine and you're not talking about the ribs and the shoulder joints that Joelle was inserting as we worked out where and how the parts of the thread that she was writing fitted in, if you see what I'm saying.
Mm-hmm.
And once we had finished that, she basically wrote her scenes and I wrote my scenes, and then hers were sent to me, generally, while it was still in progress.
Yeah.
And then I was incorporating them into a master document at my end, that we were sending back and forth with the comments on it. So there's, in some ways, it would be fair to say that the primary story arc was mine. But if you say that, It's a dreadfully incomplete statement. If you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the fact that you reach a point where you can't really say, this is where David's part begins and this is where Joelle's part begins. They merge. Okay. I mean, there are scenes in here that are absolutely, Joelle wrote this one, David wrote this one. Okay. There absolutely are. There are also scenes in here where by the time we got done tweaking and pushing them back and forth, there's a lot of us from both sides in them.
Okay. Which kind of makes them sound like Linda.
Yeah, really, yeah. Well, and another thing that happened is that we had to get onto the same page in terms of where the two civilizations in question are going. Why they're doing what they're doing. When I put together the original tech Bible on the multiverse, which is large, I built the political structure on both sides, which provides the framework for what's going on. But you get into questions of individual motivation and where they're going and so forth. And that's another place where the whole collaborative bouncing stuff back and forth can really, really help. I really enjoyed this. There were times when, because of schedule issues, because I don't multitask well when I write, and I had other projects going on. And so I would be pulling out of one of them to do this, and then I had to get back into that one. Sometimes that was a little bit of a strain, a little hard. But overall, this was a very enjoyable project for me. I like working with Joelle. Now, I do think that Joelle is harder on herself than she needs to be.
I'm just trying not to repeat the same mistake twice.
Yes, well, I understand that, but, you know, it's...
But in a 700-some page book, well...
Hey, yeah.
Sometimes I misspell the same word twice, and sometimes, you know, just happens.
Well, it's like the other day I was talking to my daughters, and I forget who, but it was something about, you don't think you ever make mistakes, do you, Danny? I said, of course I do. I made one just back in 1973, I think it was. You know, yeah, in March. You know, and they were like, sure, Dad. You know? But I will say, that I've never seen you make the same mistake twice.
Except for that. I'm fooled.
Except for that bit about not wanting to use enough words. Okay. That I had to beat you over a couple of times, but by and large, no, I don't think you
Well, I think Marla had made a joke, and I took it as this is a direct order from the publisher.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. Well, you know that for a while there, they were pairing Steve Sterling with female authors trying to tone down the carnage, and they were given as their assignment trying to get the book written without a rape scene in it.
God.
And the problem they had was that all of the women that they paired him with decided they wanted to out-Sterling Steve Sterling. there's actually a scene in one of them where Jote, the heroine, is being pursued by the bad guys, and she leads them through this place where she's put, like, microfilament wire across the passageway, and about four of them run into the wire and get sliced and diced, and they're flopping around on the deck in bits and pieces. And Annie McCaffrey did that scene. Not wow. Steve. I was like, Annie, I never knew. She was like, neither did I. But that's another thing that happens in collaboration.
Wow.
Yeah.
John, you have anything?
No, I'm really intrigued by listening to the dynamics that go on in the collaboration, because it's kind of hard for me to imagine achieving that kind of synergy in writing. Like, cause for me, I write solo, and it's interesting to hear how the interplay actually plays out.
Well, okay, it helps that, you know, I have a split personality, so I'm used to working with other people. you know, I've been collaborating with Skippy for years now.
Skippy's an excellent writer.
Yes, he is, you know. But I think one of my favorite authors is Louis L'Amour. And he once said that he could write in a driving rain in the middle of a prairie, that he was not especially temperamental when he was writing. I cannot make that claim. But I can say that something that Bob Asprin said once many, many years ago. Bob and I did not get along in a lot of ways, but I thought this was a very insightful statement that he made at a science fiction convention. Mm-hmm. He said, successful writers are like rats. If we don't wear our fingers down on the keyboard every day, our fangs grow through our brains and kill us. And there really is some truth to that, you really, if you're going to succeed, if you're going to tell the stories and tell them in sufficient richness and quantity to be able to actually support yourself doing this for a living, you almost have to have that compulsion to tell stories.
Mm-hmm.
And the problem that I have, which is actually not a bad one to have, is that I have more stories to tell than I have time in which to tell them. Okay, trust me, that's a lot better problem to have than a contract and no idea at all what you're going to do with that contract.
Right.
But it means that, do you ever read the book, The Plague Dogs?
Yes.
Oh yeah.
Okay, I'm gonna keep writing till the dark comes down. I do hope that when the time comes that I am no longer doing good work, not necessarily my best work, but good work, that I will say to myself, okay, it's time to hang it up and, you know, get out of the way, let somebody else do it. Because you owe your readers good work. I get upset with some people who start talking about the compact between the reader and between the writer and his readers. Because I've seen some people who think that that compact has an awful lot of subclauses. But I do think that I don't think of myself as an artist. I think of myself as a craftsman. And I think of myself as owing the reader an honest day's work for an honest dollar. Okay, I don't tell the stories just as a way to make money, although for the last 20 years, that's what I've done. I tell the stories because I want to tell the stories, because I need to, because I love to, etc. But having said that, if I'm going to do a story and I'm going to offer it for sale to my readership, then my readership is entitled to expect certain things from that story. And they are entitled to give it a 2-star review on Amazon, which has happened to me, believe it or not, if they don't think that's what that book produced. Now, by the same token, I am free to say, well, you obviously didn't read the book I wrote. Or wait, you completely misinterpreted what's happening there. If you go back and read chapter 3, you'll discover you're wrong about, you know, what you're complaining about. So it works both ways. But that does not and cannot relieve me of my responsibility to do the best work that I can in anything that I turn loose for publication. Sometimes, especially when you're a production writer, you have to say, okay, it's time to let this book go, even if it is less than completely perfect. I could spend a year and a half polishing almost any book I've ever written and still find places to improve it. Okay? And so one of the things you have to do if you're going to be a professional writer is you have to be willing to let your baby go. There's only one book that if I could, I would take back and do a complete re-edit on. And we may actually do that at some point. And the problem there was that we got hit by a production schedule glitch. Another project blew up and I had to go play Fire Brigade on it. And this book never got the final editing pass that most of my books do. And I probably would have squeezed at least 25,000 words out of it in that final editing process. And so Tony and I have actually talked about the possibility of my going back and doing a re-edit of that book and are issuing it as, you know, this is the re-edited book, which, unlike most re-edited books, would get shorter rather than longer.
Shorter director's cut.
Yeah, well, in reverse.
Editor's cut.
Yeah. Okay. Ooh. Ow. That would go deeper to the bone. Although I will tell you that the very first novel that I ever wrote, well, that was purchased, the collaboration Insurrection with Steve White. In the original submission draft, it was 180,000 words long. And in the original rough draft before we submitted it, it was 280,000 words long. And I cut 100,000 words out of it before we submitted it. And the final version of that book was only like 130,000 words because we were newbies. Nobody knew who we were. And with that, they didn't want to take a chance on that much page count with new writers.
Yeah.
And when we did the omnibus version of the Starfire books, the version of Insurrection that's in that one has like 15,000 words in it that weren't in the original novel, where I went back and restored one of the last plot strands that we cut out in order to get it down to 130,000 words. So that was kind of fun.
And that's why I still have that paperback.
Well, Insurrection was fun. Although, actually, the very first novel that I submitted was the original version of Sword of the South, the fantasy novel that came out last year. And it was thoroughly rejected. And it was not, when the version of it that finally saw print, it was tightened in some places because God knows I have thankfully learned a thing or two in the last 20 odd years about writing, but it's still the same story. The primary changes in it were to account for the Oath of Swords, War God's Own stories, which obviously didn't exist when I wrote that one. And the multiverse is one of the 10 concepts that I pitched to Jim Bain when he bought the Honor Harrington series. The Safehold books are another one of them. If you read the third of the Dahak novels, Heirs of Empire, a lot of people said, oh, well, you know, you just took all that stuff you did on Pardal and turned it into a series. No, what happened was that I didn't think I was going to get to write the series, so I used some of the concepts from it in Heirs of Empire. So it's the one thing I ever did that really pissed Jim Bain off. I was working on a novel that wouldn't come together. It just wouldn't. And I'd gotten about 80,000 words in and realized that it was a prequel to Path of the Fury. And I realized that I hadn't made the technology set like 300 years early. It was the creation of the empire of the Terran Empire. And I hadn't made the technology 300 years cruder. And how the technology worked out was critical to how the war worked out. So I had 80,000 words, and I said, oh, geez, this isn't going to work. So I put them over to one side, and I started over again, and oh, that book was fighting me. You know, I'll normally get between 3,000 and 7,000 words a day, and I was doing lucky to get like 200 on this. And so Jim called me up, and he said, how's it going? I said, oh, it's not going well. He said, oh, how bad is it? I told him, he said, well, why don't you do something else? And I said, Jim, I got a contract to do this book. And he said, yes, and who is that contract with? And I said, you? And he said, then if I tell you to do something else, it's all right for you to do something else. So I did. And then about 2-3 years later, he called me and he said, Dave, I've been thinking, you know, you got like 80,000 words on that, you know, Path of the Fury novel before you pulled off of it. And I said, yeah. And he said, well, what if we just kind of filed off the serial numbers, put new character, you know, names in it and so forth, and did it as a standalone? And I said, well, that'd be cool, but I don't have it anymore. And he said, you mean you can't find it immediately? And I said, no. It was on the hard drive for one of my computers that blew up, and it couldn't be recovered. And he said, and you didn't have it on floppy? And I said, well, yeah, I had it on floppy, but I don't have any idea where it is. You know, it's probably in a bunch that I threw away, floppy disks. And he's like, you threw away 80,000 words of a David Weber novel. And I said, well, yeah, and there's silence from the other end of the phone line for a few seconds. And he says, repeat after me. I will never throw anything away. I said, but Jim. He said, don't you but Jim me. You know, I was like, okay. I made the mistake of telling Tony that I have an entire file cabinet drawer here in my office that has probably got 300 or 400 short stories in it. And they really are short stories that are never going to be published. And because I did them because there was something I wanted to work on, you know, some little piece of characterization or something. And she said, what do you mean they'll never be published? I said, they'll never be published. I won't have them published. And she looked at me and said, you won't live forever. And I said, Tony, I'm just saying, I'm younger than you are. I'll burn them all.
So how is that new will going then, David?
Yeah, right. Well, you know all the weight that I've lost okay? She says that their insurance underwriter says they can probably write a better life insurance policy on me now. And I'm like, Tony, I don't want you to have a better life insurance policy on me. I want to be worth more alive than dead. But I have to say, I feel very fortunate to have fallen into Bane Books' clutches when I did. Jim Bane, in a lot of ways, I don't think the field realized everything that he had done until we lost him. I mean, those of us who knew him and worked with him knew he could occasionally be socially maladroit. Okay. But he was as good-hearted as the day was long. He was a brilliant editor when he edited. And I honestly believe that Jim Bane knew more about growing a new author's readership than almost anybody else in the field. And not only that, he was incredibly generous. I know of authors who had hit serious health problems, who Jim would go ahead and write contracts to and hand over in advance, knowing that the chance was at least even that the book would never be written, or that if it was written, it would have to be written by a junior partner, collaborator down the road. And we just don't have enough people like that. I feel very honored to have known him and to have had him. I think probably the three people in the field, four, that I feel most privileged to have known. And there are a lot of people who would come in right below these four in that catalog. But I would say Jim Bane, Roger Zelazny, Fred Saberhagen, and Annie McCaffrey. Those are probably the four that have been absolutely the biggest joy. I mean, I met Andre and we corresponded, but by the time I met her, she really was no longer producing. She was at High Halleck, and was a charming lady, but not the Andre who had produced all of those dozens and dozens of wonderful books. Because she was no longer writing. I know I talked to her once, I guess 2 years before she died. I was visiting her briefly at High Halleck. And I said, you know, your stuff, it's always going to be around. And she said, no, it's not. And I said, yeah. She said, no, they don't want to publish it anymore. I was like, what are you talking about? You're Andre Norton, you know? And I went away from that conversation a little saddened, but I got to thinking about it, and I've actually read a couple of reviews of Andre Norton books by people who don't realize when they were written that say, yeah, but so-and-so did it better first. Mm-hmm. And they don't realize that Andre did it in 1953.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. That all of the protagonist as other in science fiction, in a lot of ways, started with her. All right? And I think that's sad. I think that if you look at the books that have endured as living literature, the plays that have endured as living literature rather than something your English prof makes you read, almost all of them were popular entertainment when they were produced. Okay? They were not, oh, this is for the literati or whatever. It was something that had broad-based appeal, and what gave it that broad-based appeal was the universality of the concepts and the persons involved in it. I think you can see that in Twain. I think you can see it in Dickens in some respects, but he is much more Victorian than Twain was in his writing style. You can clearly see it in Shakespeare. If wonderful, wonderful project that was done at one of the schools here in South Carolina, they took Shakespeare and took the verse out of it, published it as regular sentences without breaks at the ends of the sentences or anything else, and turned a bunch of high school kids loose on it. And they ate it up like candy because they weren't trying to read it as poetry, which was not how it was delivered at the time anyway. Okay? And that's the kind of literature that I want to be associated with, is the kind that actually speaks to the reader. There are passages in my books that I'm proud of, but I have to say that in some respects I think that frequently style detracts from the story. There are some stylists, and Roger Zelazny was one of them, where the style moves the story forward, impels the story. Patricia McKillop is another person that that's true of. Mm-hmm. There are other people where the style becomes what you're looking at, and the reason you read that person is because of the style, the turn of phrase, the language that's used. And sometimes that takes away from the story they're telling, because it focuses your attention in the wrong place. My theory is that the story works best when you don't even notice my style, and you still get to where I wanted you to be when I wrote the passage. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And sometimes I manage it, sometimes I don't. And every so often I've got one where I just say, okay, fine. I want to put on my stylist hat. Okay? But I take off my tinfoil colander that keeps the aliens from reading my brains. You know.
And you let Skippy free.
I let Skippy free. I be free, Skippy, be free. And then I go back and look and say, what was that? You know. I had somebody who told me that I needed to get a pica from the Safehold series to finish up some of the series that I'm not finishing, that I can't, not getting to. And I said, well, that won't work because it would just start spinning off more series of its own.
True.
What can I say? I don't know. You know, I guess that I probably am one of the more prolific writers out there. I, to be honest, don't know exactly how many novels I have out right now, counting both collaborations and solos, but I think it's got to be pushing the 60, 65.
Yeah, I'm looking at my bookshelves, and that's, yeah.
But, it's not, I'm not, you know, the one who dies with the most books out is still dead, okay?
Yeah.
It works that way. But I just, I don't know. I always thought that I was going to teach history and write on the side. That was what I thought all the way through college and graduate school. And then I realized, I saw a demographic study just about the time I was finishing up my master's thesis. It said that over half of all tenured history positions in the United States were held by people who were 40 or younger. Yeah. And that we were losing like 1% or 2% of all tenured positions on history faculties per year at that point, with sociology and political science and whatnot eating up that position on faculty. And so I decided, okay, fine, you know, I'm going to go back, take over my mom's little advertising agency because she was planning on shutting it down and moving down to Georgia to take care of her mom. And it was about 3 years after that that I sold, Steve and I sold Insurrection. And maybe one of these days when I can finally slow down a little bit, maybe I'll be kind of an author in residence on one of the campuses here in the Greenville area and teach on the side. Because I had a quadruple assistantship in graduate school, and I loved it. Absolutely loved it. I'm not sure I'd be a good fit for academia 30 years later. Okay, I'd be like, oh no, not that dinosaur, you know. But that love of history, I don't know if you can see it in what I write. It's a minor factor in my thinking.
Just a bit.
Here and there. But history is a very good discipline for somebody who wants to write science fiction. Because, genuinely, science fiction is always at least an extrapolation from existing human experience. And the more history you know, the better you can extrapolate. And that's a huge secret to successful world building. And I think that it also should be a requirement to vote. Because you get people who are voting with, on both sides, with absolutely no sense of the continuity of the issues. But from a writer's perspective, oh my God, the richness of history, in terms of story concepts and personalities and conflict resolution and sources of conflict. And I'm not talking necessarily about military conflict. I'm talking about, go back and look at the philosophes or the Renaissance and see what the pressures, the stresses, what movement was grinding. People have a tendency to think of history as this is the way it is. And the problem is that we think of history as a series of snapshots, a series of still pictures. And what we should actually be thinking of are frames in a movie. Mm-hmm. Because of the fact that it's ongoing. And that's one of the feelings that I try to bring to the science fiction that I write. That's why the technology progresses. That's why the political struggles change. And I think that's one of the secrets to the success that I've had. That and the fact that I kill a lot of people in very spectacular explosions. Do a lot of that in history, too.
I might have had a very good friend complain when I told her that I was going to be co-writing with you that she didn't want me to kill off characters for the success of my literary career. I didn't learn that lesson from you.
Yes. Well,
I told her I was making no promises.
Well, Taylor Anderson is in trouble with Sharon now, because he killed off two of her favorite characters in the Destroyerman book that she's reading. She's like, oh, he is in so much trouble when I see him again.
This concludes part one of our discussion with Joel Presby and David Weber. Stay tuned and watch your feeds for part two, which will include the rest of the discussion with our guests and then continue with January's Culture Consumed, Among the Three Horsemen. Thanks, and have a good day.